This Be Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate, so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K through 12th grade curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. If you want to bring IXL to your school, you can learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE. We're proud to be sponsored by MyFlex Learning. MyFlex Learning is a scheduling platform that helps middle and high schools meet the individual needs of all students. Schools can easily create and manage time for flex blocks, activity periods, RTI, therapy, and teacher appointments, and much more. With its built-in accountability tool and reporting features, MyFlex Learning solves your challenges around getting kids where they need to be and understanding how flex time is spent. Make your flex time work for you. Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off the first year. That's myflexlearning.com/BE. This is Dr. Karen, and you are listening to the De Facto Leaders Podcast on the Be Podcast Network, where I share up-to-date, evidence-based practices, my own experiences, and guest interviews designed to help pediatric therapists, educators, and aspiring school leaders design services that support social, emotional, and academic growth and set kids up for success in adulthood. Whether you want to learn effective strategies for your therapy session or classroom, be an influential leader on your team, or find creative ways to use your skills to advance in your career, I've got you covered. Hey there, it's Dr. Karen, and welcome to episode 152 of the De Facto Leaders Podcast on the Be Podcast Network. People working in school or medical settings are in a position to be caring for others in their professional lives, which makes it difficult to leave work at work. When you combine that with relationships outside of work, family responsibilities, or having a child with a disability, there's a high risk of burnout. That's why I invited Chrissy Mombella to episode 152 of De Facto Leaders to discuss this topic because she's had lived experience as a teacher, a school administrator, and as a parent. Chrissy is the program director for the REACH Initiative through the Partnership for Resilience. She leads the REACH Communities of Practice, and her work allows her to be a thought partner and leader in the implementation and evaluation of the REACH Initiative, a strategic partnership with the Center for Childhood Resilience at Lurie Children's Hospital, and the support of the Illinois State Board of Education. With over 25 years of public education experience as a special ed teacher and administrator, Chrissy's focus is on developing systems that support connection, innovation, and belonging within school communities. Chrissy earned her bachelor's with a concentration in special ed from Northern Illinois University and her master's in educational administration from Loyola University. This episode is the first part of our conversation. We actually had a lengthy conversation that I ended up having to split up into two episodes because she was sharing so many good things. So this is the first part of the conversation about social emotional learning for adults in education and healthcare. We discuss what compassion fatigue is and why self-care alone won't solve it. Chrissy shares her experience having a child with ADHD, including what it's like to be on the other side of the table as a parent in an IEP meeting, how to set expectations with your child's school team so you're an active participant, reframing the word discipline, especially as it applies to schools, and why discipline doesn't have to be punitive, how to embed social emotional learning across the day, and why it has to be practiced in context for both kids and adults. And then we wrap up by talking about the impact of giving kids the opportunity to contribute to their community. You'll really want to stick around until the end because she shares a really great story and an example of how she was able to embed social emotional learning as well as engage her students through giving them the opportunity to contribute. And you'll also want to make sure that you check the show notes for all of the links to the resources that she mentions in this first half of the conversation. Many of the topics that we cover in this episode are related to what I show you how to do in the School of Clinical Leadership, my program that helps related service providers guide their teams to support students' executive functioning across the day. So executive functioning is really important to self-regulation, which ties in to the conversation about social-emotional learning, as well as the idea of restoring and repairing relationships, and the importance of modeling this for kids, as well as teaching them to regulate and learning how to regulate ourselves as well. When we think about executive functioning, it's not just about the direct intervention piece, it's about the entire system that we're working in. And that can be super challenging in that related service provider role, but you can make an impact when you have the right plan and system. So that's why the School of Clinical Leadership helps you to plan direct therapy, but also helps you to lead change on your school team, no matter your job title. You can learn more about the School of Clinical Leadership at drkarendudekbrandon.com/clinical-leadership. Now, please enjoy this first part of my conversation with Chrissy Mumbella. Today, I am joined by Chrissy Mumbella from the Partnership for Resilience. So thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to talk about all kinds of different topics, but I thought we'd start off by having you just share a little bit about yourself and where you started and what led to the work that you're doing now.
Sure. So when you mentioned that question before, I was like, well, that's a big question. So it's going to be, you know, there's a lot. So I've spent the last over 25 years in public education. First, I was a special education teacher and also an administrator at the school and district level. And originally, I began in special ed because I have older siblings with intellectual disabilities. And I was curious. And as a 17-year-old starting out college, I was curious as to how that medical and educational model kind of connected and how that played a role. And at first I thought about pediatric nursing, but then I pivoted to special ed. And that curiosity really stayed with me throughout my experiences. Really looking at like the whole child and brain research and how experiences and how everything's interconnected. That was a focus for me. And so when I wrote IEPs and when I led teams, I would share that we are telling the story of a child when we're writing this IEP. And that IEP needs to tell the story, the whole story, not just the deficits. And really the question that I always had are, what are the glows and grows that make this child shine? But then, you know, kind of thinking about all of that, I then had children of my own. And one of my children, he was identified as being twice exceptional. And I found myself on the other side of the table. And that really changed and shaped the trajectory of my career, my experiences, because I had the experience of not only the stress of the unknown as I was navigating a parent and parenting a brilliant child who had some of the worst executive functioning and problem solving abilities, but also I started to look at the stress of the teams and how that impacted them thinking about like meeting the expectations of, because they knew my background in special ed. So now I'm watching these team members really look at like, okay, I have to write the lengthy, you know, legal documents, and I'm creating this with creating this to share with families, and thinking about how do you strike that balance between hope and reality. Mm-hmm. And so in my second year as a director, I was learning alongside my colleagues district-wide from the Illinois Education Association about trauma. So when I first started, in that role. There was a lot of turnover in the position, and in speaking, I went on a listening tour, talking to administrators of buildings, talking to special ed staff, talking to some, general education staff who were up for meeting with me. And I saw the level of stress that they were under, and I started to just kind of question, like, what can we do to support that? And found that the Illinois Education Association had this framework around trauma-responsive schools. So I looked into it, and when I spoke with them, they said, we're happy to work with you, and we'll work with you free of charge, but you have to make sure that your union representatives and your school district leaders are in agreement. So that was the first stage. So I went and met with my superintendent, met with our union president at the time, and we brought this training to our schools. And when we started to work through it and listen and learn, we were like, ooh, there's a lot going on here. There's a lot more about learning that gets impacted by understanding trauma. And so when I started to take the time really to lean into caring for myself and for staff and for administrative peers as much as possible, I began to see more clearly the toll it was taking on all of us, the pressures and the expectations that we all were carrying with us. And so once the pandemic hit and I was in a different district, different experiences, I started to have some medical issues, and I could not keep up with the pace. And it led me to going from having some compassion fatigue to then going into a space of burnout. I started to, and I could feel it, like I could physically feel it in my body. And I find this is going to sound crazy that I'm saying it this way, but I found that to be a blessing that I had this training, because I started to go, okay, what's the difference between what I am experiencing and what I was experiencing? Because I felt the pressures and the heaviness of the pandemic, specifically with children with disabilities, because I started to have to navigate learning differently. So, here, if it came to like what we would think of as invisible disabilities, like learning disabilities, ADHD and so
Things that
forth,
you can't see.
we could find, we were able to provide the services. It wasn't as perfect, but we could find it and we were able to do it. But then I was navigating situations that it was for children with significant disabilities, children who were incredibly dysregulated, parents who were having to sit next to their child in order for them to do any type of engagement. And this is remote learning. And I was going through and looking for all kinds of situations and experiences, and it just wasn't there. And I was like, okay, how do I get clear on helping? And while I'm doing all of this, I'm dealing with my own medical issues. And I started to feel the burnout come in. I was dreading going into work. I started to have panic attacks. I've never had panic attacks. Started to have panic attacks. And the level of exhaustion, both my husband and my children were saying, like, Mom, we're worried about you. Like, we're seeing it take a toll on you. And at that point, I decided, you know what? I need to get clear. I need to get a better understanding of what's going on. So I went to a place. This was we were still in the pandemic, but things had loosened in terms of travel and whatnot. And so I went to the place that centers me and heals me every time. And I went with my family, and we went to Puerto Rico, and that's where my family is originally from. And the first thing I did, I told my family, I said, as soon as we get a chance, we've landed, we've rested. The next day, we are heading to my family's from the northern part of Puerto Rico. There's a small area called Vega Baja. And so we drove there, and I went straight to where my father is resting. So I went to his grave to lean in and just get still and grounded to know what to do. I needed that guidance. I needed to know, like, what do I need to do? And I sat up, and with tears in my eyes, I said, I need to pivot out of this work. I know I need to, I know I want to still work with children. I know I need to still influence and impact, but I can't be the director that I want to be any longer. And I needed to take care of myself because I was really struggling. And so it made sense for me to pivot out of public education, which was never, ever a thought that I had, but after 25 years, I decided to do that. And yet I still wanted to work on supporting schools. So within months of that decision, I had this incredible opportunity to work on an initiative that supports trauma responsiveness in schools, which really speaks to the core of my why. Like, I really think about how can we make sure that humanity is in education? How do we get clear on, like, do I see the humanity in you and do you see the humanity in me? And so I work for an organization, the Partnership for Resilience, that actually started from work of the Illinois Education Association. And it was really the IEA president at the time and her brother, who is a doctor, a pediatric doctor. They both started to look at, like, how do we bring these two worlds together? Because they both, you know, you're in helping professions, but how do you bring this together to really understand how trauma impacts the spaces children are in? And so I work for the Partnership for Resilience, and we're a nonprofit organization that focuses on mitigating the effects of toxic stress and trauma on children and families. So we work in all community spaces, schools, we help to support that. And I ended up leading, and I'm now leading, which is amazing, the work of the REACH Initiative, which is Resilience Education to Advance Community Healing. And we are statewide, and we work on helping to develop trauma responsiveness across the state of Illinois. And it is a partnership with Lurie's Children's Hospital and the Illinois State Board of Education. The Partnership for Resilience and the Stress and Trauma Treatment Center are the original members of this initiative. And it's really branched out from there. So it's been amazing. We work with the social emotional learning hubs, which are the regional offices of education. There's six of them across the state. And I lead what's called the communities of practice, which is really a professional learning group that brings people together from across the state or the region or in a district, depending on which one you're in. And it's really about the topics of trauma responsiveness, you know, whole school trauma programming. It follows really the alignment of the it's the TRSIA, which is the Trauma Responsive Schools Implementation Assessment. And so we look at those different domains, and the ones that really are resonating with people to work on first and foremost is whole school trauma programming, also looking at prevention, also looking at staff self-care, because that is a really a need, especially with compassion fatigue, and then also looking at classroom-based strategies. And that was probably a long answer to your
Yeah, no, it's
question,
great. I
but it
love
all
it.
kind of ties together.
Yeah, and that is how I connected with you, is because you were doing a training for, it was for ISBE, correct?
Yes, it
And
was. Yes.
yeah, so oh man, so many questions, but I it's just with this topic, there's so much nuance, and it's like I, as somebody who puts out content, it's always so hard to give context to what you're saying, because as like there's so much talk about self-care with the professionals and with kids, and it's like in my own career, as we've kind of chatted before we started recording, it's like, when do I need to take a break and when do I need to go and actually be engaged in work? And it's sometimes it's one way and sometimes the other. And I think that having that awareness of being able to ask those questions is really important, because I can recall times too where I was just overworked, and like you said, the compassion fatigue, which I wanted to get into in a minute. But then there's other times where it's like, you know what? I actually need to go and get out there and engage more. And sometimes that's what's going to feel more restorative. And that's sort of where I was this past year, where it was, okay, I pivoted, and now I want to come back. And there's a lot to it. And then I think that with trauma too, it's there's so much back and forth of, when do you create a boundary? When do you yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll get into all of that, but I thought where we could start was just maybe even defining compassion fatigue and why it's so likely to happen in people who are in education and healthcare. Like, why is it can happen to anyone who's caring for someone else, but why is it so common in education?
So the definition I reference for compassion fatigue is that, you know, and some people will see this as vicarious trauma, so they kind of seem a little bit interchangeable. Is that it is compassion fatigue is really the cost of caring for others, or their emotional pain, resulting in really the desire to help relieve that suffering from, you know, of others. So it's like, it's almost like that emotional residue, if you will, of this exposure that you've had, right? So this can be exposure from one case. It can be like the cumulative exposure to levels of trauma. And you know, we see that in the helping professions. And so when we see this happen, you know, it's like it's almost like it's a dark cloud that follows you. You know, your heart and mind become heavy because there are these times you feel helpless and don't know what to do or where to go with that heaviness. And so that's that compassion fatigue. It's almost like, you know, where people think, oh, well, you know, you end your work day and you move on. When you have compassion fatigue and you've been helping families and helping, you know, children or even your colleagues, it carries with you throughout. So you don't just leave it at the door. It's like lingering because you keep thinking about what can I do differently or what can, how can I help in this way? So it's that emotional residue to think about that you may have from learning about the traumatic stories and experiences that other people go through.
And then maybe even if you're when you're a parent and then you come home and you have some things in your family that you're working through as well, maybe personally or with your children or your partner. And yeah, that's hard when you are in a position where you're taking care of people all day. And then you come home and you have similar, maybe a similar situation. If you have a child who has one a diagnosis that's similar to some of the kids that you're supporting at school, then it's like you want to come home and recharge for yourself, but it's like you're coming home to another work day in a way.
Yes, and there was a period of time where I was experiencing that, right? Like, you know, here I was dealing with children with disabilities, working through all of that at work, and then fast forward and I'm coming home and my son was diagnosed with ADHD and in third grade, so this was many years ago. And he would literally, his executive functioning skills, he'd have all this work to do. And we would sit there for hours just getting things to be initiated. Like he could not initiate. And it's fascinating because here I am, somebody who's trained in knowing what to do and how to do it. And yet it was like I was completely like my emotional brain was like hijacking me because I'm like, I just, you know, because I'm in the parent role, so I'm not in this teacher role. And trying to help him with that after school and knowing all the strategies and tools and whatnot, and I'm communicating with his teachers. And at that time, you know, he's now a senior in high school. But at that time, it was so hard to do both. And I think that absolutely that compassion fatigue can weigh in and any of those caretaking, helping professions, not just in education or, you know, as a caregiver, but when you think about medicine and psychological therapy and social work, any of those life coaching, it shares. I think it increased really with the pandemic. You know, we were seeing,
It
hearing
did.
about compassion fatigue before that, but then afterwards, the numbers increased dramatically. And we started to see shortages in teaching and school psychology and school social work. And although it's not reported as much, there are administrative positions that are becoming harder to fill. And so I just think that that line got way too blurred and it became harder.
I have heard people say the same thing about special ed administration. So, in Illinois specifically, that so I'm licensed for speech pathology and special ed administration, and some of the administrators that I've talked to in the Chicago area are like, well, you just named two places where there's huge needs right now. So yeah, I know with pretty much what I've heard from people who are in administration is that there's huge shortages, even with principals as well. I'm not sure about superintendents, but that just nationally, statewide, in administration in general, that it's hard to find people who, to fill those roles as well. And it's not just teachers. I know there's huge shortages. And then it's hard for the people who are in there when they don't have the support to, cover all their caseload or cover all of the needs. That does get really hard. So yeah, I'm curious what that was like with because it's really interesting how you said your emotional brain hijacks you, because I know exactly what you mean, where it's I know the strategies and I've trained people on this, but then you lose all your objectivity when it's a person that is, you know, this important person in your life. And it feels very different. So, and you know, I remember being in the role of, you know, a person who's running the IEP meeting. And then when you have somebody who you know is also in the same profession as you, I remember feeling a little intimidated being that person who was like, well, this person is a special ed teacher. They work with, you know, this population. And so I wonder how, like, what was that like for you when you were on the parent side and they know that you also have this robust background in training?
So I will say it depended on the school. So like
Yeah.
when he was in elementary school, they knew my background and they were super collaborative with me. They were super supportive with me. You know, there were times where we had to pause and like explain certain things to his dad because he's
Yeah.
like, all these terms I do not know. Like,
Yeah.
so I knew all of those things. And so that there was that collaboration there. For whatever reason, when it pivoted to junior high, it was a very different experience. And that was harder for me because one, special ed teaching for me was primarily, and this was for like half of my career, is I was a special ed self-contained emotional disability, learning disability teacher in junior high. So like 6th through 8th grade that's like the grades I love. So here I am in that space and they're not taking the same care. Well, then I would get a little bit difficult. And what I mean by that is I was looking for drafts of paperwork and they weren't being sent. And so when I went to the meeting and I said, how can I be an informed individual participating meaningfully in this meeting if you have not shared with me the reports for me to review prior to? Because, you know, and I always took that into consideration for parents. And regardless of, you know, where parents were with their understanding of things, I would talk with my team about it's really important that we give context, let them know we're not making decisions, but help them to come in as an informed participant in this, a meaningful participant in this. And so when that didn't happen, and this was his first IEP for 6th grade, and the person's like, oh, we're just going to remove this. And I'm like, how are you going to do that without this? And so what I realized was this person was new to her administrative role and probably didn't necessarily do some background into my experience because the rest of the team was like, oh no. Like, oh no. And so I could tell, right? And so after I spoke with her, I said, look, I am going to want from you what I strive for, what I provide families. And in my mind, it didn't matter if that family had an attorney or an advocate or was a second language, you know, English was their second language. We should always give them the care they need to understand what their child is navigating. Because if you don't, then the likelihood is greater that by the time, if they got diagnosed very early on in school, by the time they get to 6th, 7th, 8th grade, you're going to see less engagement, less involvement, not because they don't care, but because they don't feel seen or valued or heard. And so I took the opportunity rather than to get reactive and defensive with this particular person to really help kind of in some ways informally coach and say, look, you're a new coordinator. It would have helped for you to look at my background, one, and two, it also helps to recognize like it's really important for parents to come in, caregivers to come in informed in the best way they can be to be able to meaningfully ask questions and participate.
I mean, even just from the equity piece, I can think of times where it's like, oh, this parent's gonna ask a lot of questions. Let's really be prepared. Well, you should do that for everybody. You should do that regardless of, you know, whether or not they're going to be agreeable to things or whether they're going to come in with an advocate or an attorney or whatever it is. I
Yeah,
mean, that's,
absolutely.
yeah.
Because the number one thing, regardless of like any parents, is parents want to know, caregivers want to know, do you see my child? Do you see them? Like truly see them? And I think what made me start thinking about maybe those rushing through IEPs was we started to prioritize, not because we intentionally wanted to prioritize, but because people were feeling burned out. And I think that also plays a role in how we show up for these situations.
I'd love to get into that with I feel like there's when you're handling all those situations, it sometimes feels like I'm kind of not flipping, but you know, you talk to certain people in a certain group and you're like, oh wow, like, you know, if you talk to a lot of parents, then you're kind of on the side of, you know, the parent advocate side. But then, you know, then I would spend a lot of time talking to administrators and see things that people were saying about school administrators. And then I feel like I'm defending them. Like it's, you know, there's always, I think it always benefits people to come to those interactions thinking, even though this person that I'm talking to, I feel like they have power over the situation. Like this is an administrator, they can decide what happens in their building, but also they're a human trying to do their job and they're doing the best that they can. So just remembering that, because it just, you know, again, I being in the role that I have the last 5 years, I see a lot of things being said on social media where the nuance of the situation is lost. And I always feel like I'm floating around to the different people being like, but what about this? What about this thing that they're experiencing? And like, you know, advocating for every single person in their role, like and it looks different in different ways. So
Yes. And I think, you know, one of the things that you brought up is that being able to see one another. And I used to use this in my classroom. And I think it's a really powerful poem. And I want to share it with you because it really kind of sets the stage for everything we're talking about. And I used it actually as my classroom guidelines 1 year. And it was beautiful how it ended up kind of being framed and utilized. And so the poem is, its title is Pensamiento Serpentino, which is Serpentine Thought by Luis Valdez, and it was written in 1971. And it's in Lakesh, and I'll say it in English and in Spanish, or vice versa, I should say. So it's Tú eres mi otro yo. Si te hago daño a ti, me hago daño a mí mismo. Si te amo y re respeto, me amo y respeto yo. And really, it is, you are my other me. If I do harm to you, I do harm to myself. If I love and respect you, I love and respect myself. And I really, this has really been with me for at least the last decade in my experiences and in my work, because it's that perspective taking. Administrators have a certain role they have to fulfill. And they're getting the pressures of the Board of Education, the superintendent, to do their work. Then you have teachers. Teachers have a certain role they have to fill. And they're getting the pressures from their administration, from families, and administrators also getting families too. So there's all of these interconnectedness that we all have, and we all have a role that we play. And what it comes down to is, how do we take care of one another? How do I see the humanity in you, and you see the humanity in me? And that's with anyone that we're coming in, you know, in encountering and in the interactions that we have. Because you would also see it on social media. Administrators don't understand, teachers don't understand, families don't understand. If we all don't understand, then how do we come together so that we can understand? And really, one of the things that I think about is, if we look at it, if let's say, for example, we're looking at it from like a hierarchical perspective, which we tend to do in our society. If teachers are responsible for the caretaking of children, who is taking care of the teachers from a hierarchy standpoint? Administrators. But administrators, if they're turning their back, who's taking care of them? That sometimes gets tricky. Is
Oh,
it
yeah.
the superintendent? Is it the board? Who's taking care of the administrator? Because if you're experiencing any type of compassion fatigue, which has that potentially to burnout, you aren't necessarily showing up at full capacity, which goes back to that part that I was telling you about with my own son, the amygdala hijack. My emotional brain is being hijacked. So if my emotional brain is being hijacked, how then can I show up authentically and in my full self to be a support to school, to teachers? Or if I'm an administrator, to teachers, to families, to students, and it should not be last, myself. And so I think that's something that people forget when we're creating this narrative around us versus them. It's really around we. We're all in this together. How do we make sure that we can see one another together in the space?
I wanted to take a quick break here and talk about the School of Clinical Leadership. As you're probably realizing in this conversation, social emotional learning is something that needs to be embedded across the day. This is true for kids, and this is true for the adults as well. And this goes beyond what you need to do in your direct therapy sessions if you are a related service provider, even though that is one very important piece. So that's why in the School of Clinical Leadership, I help related service providers take a stand for themselves as leaders on their team, as well as for their students. In the program, I'll help you create a comprehensive plan for putting executive functioning support in place on your school team by giving you the tools you need to influence your team. You can learn how to become a member at drkarendudekbrennan.com/clinical leadership. Let's talk about flex time in schools. The potential benefits to our students make it worth exploring. More time for personalized learning. Increased choice and agency for students. Dedicated time for intervention. Overall, as school leaders, it gives us and our faculty more tools to increase academic achievement. But the implementation and management of flex time can be a challenge. Tricky logistics and a lack of clear accountability systems can prevent teachers from buying in and can hold us back from ensuring students make good use of their time. I'm pleased to share that MyFlex Learning provides a solution to these challenges and more. MyFlex Learning helps you create and manage flex time for any purpose. Want to see it for yourself? Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off the first year of use. That's myflexlearning.com/BE. Now, let's get back to the conversation. I would love to talk about when you have teachers who are, I mean, and I think that anybody who's in education is, there's that chance that you can burn out regardless of the role that you have, but there are certain settings where there is a higher turnover, particularly the setting that you were in. And I know that you have a background with CPI training when kids are showing things like physical aggression, and where we have to take into account keeping everyone safe, keeping the students safe, keeping the other students safe, keeping the staff safe, and really understanding how discipline plays into all of this in a way that is, you know, teaching people skills and teaching them safe boundaries that are going to help them be successful later on, but at the same time, understanding their disabilities and knowing how to de-escalate and debrief. So I would love to cover that topic. I know that was something that you know a lot about. So yeah, maybe we could start off with the idea of, just maybe topics that you feel like are a way that we can help navigate all of those nuances, especially with the idea of like, how do we avoid being too punitive, but then also how do we avoid going too far in the other direction? You know, like, how do we find that balance?
Yes. And so I will say it's probably by my approach and belief might be nuanced in some ways. I don't know for some people, but the first thing I think about is when we were talking about like compassion fatigue versus burnout, where that comes into play is, first off, burnout can happen in any profession because it's really that cumulative process marked by emotional exhaustion and withdrawal associated with your occupational stress and being overworked. I share that because when you're looking at it through the lens of disability, especially if you're dealing with behavior, which we know after we returned from remote learning, schools across the country experienced extremes in behavior. And it wasn't even just with children with disabilities. It was children in general. So you're having kids who, you know, students who potentially did not have any schooling experience. So a kindergarten coming in and didn't have any preschool, or a first grader coming in and didn't have kindergarten, you know, like in a in-person setting. Mm-hmm. So you're having this happen. And so now you have, it didn't matter if there was a disabling condition or not, you have explosive behaviors. Mm-hmm. And those showed up with like kids running out of class, refusals, things being thrown across the room. That is very dysregulating for anyone and very stressful for anyone.
Yeah.
And that was already starting a little bit before the pandemic. So when I started in my role as a director several years ago, I was getting calls about children leaving the building and going across the street to someone's home and jumping into the tree. And like, and you're like, whoa, what this, this child does. And I would ask the question, does this child have an IEP? And they're like, no. I'm like, oh, okay. This is a little different. So there was already that dysregulation occurring. And there's all kinds of societal factors we can look at, you know, for that. Now that we understand adverse childhood, we are having or starting to have an experience of understanding adverse childhood experiences, knowing the ACEs study, knowing what Kaiser Permanente they did. And even if you're looking at any of Dr. Nadine Burke's work, it really gets clear on like these things that people might think, oh, well, these things happen in our world, you know, like death of a loved one, you know, or illness or divorce. They do happen, but if they happen cumulatively over time, regardless of disability or not, for children, that can lead to a lot of dysregulation in our system. And any type of behavior is a form of communication. And so when a child is acting out in a way that is not what we might deem as norm, then we have to try to better understand, okay, they are trying to express something to us. And what is it they're trying to express? And how are we going to help them to express it differently so that they can be safe and that other children can be safe and the adults that are working with them are safe? And so when I think about that, I really go back to the thought of brain science and knowing that when I was teaching very early on in my career, I started to learn more about brain-based learning. And one of the things that really resonated with me was when a child was dysregulated, they were basically living in fight or flight. They were living in their brainstem. They were in, hey, in their mind, whether it was a fictional or real tiger, that somebody's coming at me and or something's coming at me, and I got to protect myself. So when I had students who were dysregulated in the classroom, I would start to model for them how to not be dysregulated in that moment. Because it didn't matter that I taught them that while they were regulated. When you're dysregulated, you're not in this, you're not activating the same part of your brain. So how could I model for them how not to be dysregulated when they were? So we started practicing things like, hey, are you feeling like you're living in your brainstem right now? Like I taught them about the brain. I taught them how their brain worked. I said, all of us have this brain and this is what it does. And I had a little model and they could put together the model and they were like, this little part. And I was like, yeah, that's the amygdala, you know. So and it was funny because when I first started doing this, I started using an accent. And so like amygdala, I would say amygdalia all the time, and no one corrected me. And I'm like, I do. And then when I realized what I was saying wrong, I was like, oh my gosh, I've been saying this wrong the whole time.
Was that sort of I don't know, was it because you were also in a state of, really focusing on regulating yourself? I mean, if
I
it's,
think so, you know,
like sort of this default thing that maybe I'm comfortable with.
And I think that's what it was because there were certain, there's still certain words that I'll put more of an accent or a spin on. And so in that case, while I'm teaching, and I was also doing, and this was when I was first starting my administrative career. So I was doing some administrative work and terms of like, you know, doing some presentations and having to do things on brain science. And so I would just say amygdala the whole time and no one ever paused. So I was like, lesson learned. But my
I don't
students,
think I would think anything of it. I mean,
oh, that's
it's
good to know.
yeah.
I would say that because my students were always like fascinated as well because we're talking about all these medical terms. And I said, look, you're going to be a scientist. This is before I even knew that Mark Brackett's work on being an emotional scientist existed. I would just tell them like, ooh, you're going to get curious because I wanted them to be in a space of curiosity versus judging their behavior, especially because I was fortunate enough to have really good relationship building skills with my students and their families. And so with my students, I had a couple students who finally were vulnerable enough to say to me, like, how many times do I have to fail to know that I'm dumb? How many times do I have to get this wrong for somebody to tell me that I'm stupid? And in reality, I knew they weren't. I knew that this was not a and a sign of a lack of intelligence. We weren't tapping into how they knew how to learn. This kid, the student who told me this in particular, was a very physical kid. Like, he learned with his hands, he learned by doing. And so he kept coming up into spaces that were just expecting reading and writing and, you know, regurgitating what was taught and in a paper and pencil task format. And it wasn't working for him. And so I started to teach my students about their brain so that when they were dysregulated, I could then model for them how to regulate. So, and I would even show it when I was starting to get dysregulated. So for example, I had a group of eighth graders who they were not fans of doing any homework. And they were also very much fans of being incredibly disruptive in class. And so I started to, rather than like it, my former strategy would have been to raise my voice and like do all the, instead, I would start saying, you know what, I'm going to take a break. And I want you to figure out how we're going to be able to work together on this. And I would physically walk out of the room. I wouldn't leave like outright. Yeah. I would walk out of the room. I'd close the door and it would be quiet. And then I'd hear a couple kids say, hey, that's not right what we did to Miss M. We got to fix this. And then they would start talking about how they could fix it. And I would listen for that. Now, I was able to do that because I spent the first 4 to 6 weeks at the start of the school year teaching expectations. So I taught, like, when we're in silent reading, this is what silent reading looks like. But this is what silent reading doesn't look like. And we were goofy about it. Like, we did a T-chart and we were like, this is what it is and this is what it isn't. But then we also did a T-chart on this is what the students are doing. And this is what I, as a teacher, am doing. So they understood what it is that they were doing and what it is that I was doing, so that they knew, okay, in this time, at this space, if I'm doing silent reading, if I'm doing small group work, if I'm doing large group work, because I was a structured teacher, but I also wanted flexibility. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, and I just did this activity with a staff as an icebreaker, as a connector. I asked them, like, conversation level, because there's a framework called CHAMPS, which is around conversation, help, activity, movement, participation, and then I always forget the S. I'm so sorry.
We'll link to it. I'm writing down all these things that you're saying so we can link in the show notes.
So the conversation level, I want to highlight because that is from like our own personal lived experiences and our cultural background. And I don't mean just cultural, like in terms of ethnicity. I mean, like your family dynamic and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the connecting question was, when you were growing up, what was the average conversation level in your household? And how is that similar or different than the expectation in your classroom today? And they just would go and meet and talk to people. And I had a little chart, 0 being like completely silent, 5 being like, you're outdoors, you're probably shouting across the yard in some way, you know, so it's a louder voice. And we did that. And I modeled it with my colleague and I, because we were both co-presenting. She said, oh, well, my household, it was smaller. There were only 4 of us. And we were probably at what we would consider an average, a level 3. And I said, what would happen if somebody was in trouble? She's like, oh, it would be a level 5. Like, you'd hear yelling and shouting and so forth. I said, okay. In my household, the average was a level 5. There were 5 kids, 2 adults. So there's 7 of us in a household. And we were just loud, boisterous family. So blah, 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 blah. Like, there was, we would talk over each other, like all kinds of stuff. So the average was a 5. The opposite, when people were upset, it was down to like a 2. Like, ooh, you'd walk in and it'd be quiet. You're like, ooh, someone's in trouble. So how did that show up in my classroom? In her classroom, she wanted a level 3. That's what she was known. That's what she knew. That's what she was familiar with. In my classroom, I was fine with a level 5.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it. I was familiar with it. And the reason I bring that up is because when we think about discipline, if I as a teacher want a certain expectation to be done, then it's important to teach it versus assume it, even down to the way we communicate. Mm. Because if a student's coming in and they're super loud and that's not your comfort level, then it's important to teach that expectation. Otherwise, they're going to come in super loud. You're going to ask them to be quiet. They may not know how to be their voice to be lowered or know really well how to do it. They're then getting in trouble, then it escalates. And so then you go from a child who was probably regulated to potentially being dysregulated because they don't understand why they're in trouble now because they're just talking, right? I'm just talking. What's the problem? I'm just talking.
Right.
And then it becomes this larger thing. The other pieces that I get curious about is that when I ask people, how they define discipline. And I just say, use a couple words, like in potentially creating like a word cloud or something along those lines. People think of discipline as punitive and of discipline as a compliance indicator. So it's almost like spare the rod, spoil the child. You must be punitive. They must get punished if they don't do something.
Right.
But yet when we pivot to adulthood and we talk about discipline, discipline becomes about
That's
like
interesting.
Our focus, our inner discipline, our inner, like our consistency. So we pivot the meaning. So I'm curious as to why we have it in the zero tolerance, punishment, compliance based mindset for children, but for adults, we expect something different.
And that is really interesting.
And, and that I am curious about, because it's like, well, when I look at the actual meaning of the word, like if you look at and you break down the word discipline, and you look at it from its Latin root, it's around in students and instruction. So if its meaning is to instruct, to teach, to be a student who's taking in, why then at a child level are we taking it as you're going to be compliant, you're going to do as I say, not as I do, and you're going to do X, Y, and Z? But it doesn't work because it doesn't help. It doesn't teach co-regulation. It doesn't teach how to be able to be in my body when I'm upset, because the reality is we all have emotions. So I find it really curious that we pivot in that way, because if a child, and especially like I think about it after the pandemic, everyone, you know, you started to hear about staff self-care, take care of yourself. And people started to become angry about saying like, take care of myself. Like nobody's taking care of me. Like, what are you talking about? And because really there is a huge difference between individual self-care and organizational care.
Yeah.
And in social emotional learning, if we look at this, in order for it to be effective, it really needs to start with adults, because our adults, you know, like looking at the competencies, and I'm in a community of practice now that I'm co-facilitating with another colleague around adult SEL. No one actually taught us, you know, like what those competencies are from a generational standpoint. Younger generations may have experienced it, but most older generations didn't have an experience of learning about, you know, self-awareness and self-management and decision-making. That wasn't a part of the conversation. So if it's not a part of the conversation, and now it is, how do we check in with understanding it ourselves so that we don't see it as some gimmicky thing we have to do with kids?
Yeah.
And instead check in with how we feel about these things, how we see these things. Because I think one of the things that happens is our language is important. So like if we are saying, I am feeling, well, I am feeling or I am thinking just means something that's happening in a certain space of time.
Mm-hmm.
If I say I am this, then it's really a state of being.
Right.
And that is a different way of framing something. So if I'm feeling anxious right now, like if I'm feeling anxious in my body right now, or I'm feeling X, Y, and Z in my body right now, that just means that it's temporary and I can work with you on that, or somebody can work with me on that. Maybe there's breathing strategies I could be doing. Maybe there's some journaling I can be doing. But if I walk around continually saying I am anxious, that I'm walking around in a heightened, that I'm basically saying I'm walking around in a heightened state.
Mm-hmm. Like it's part of me permanently, like a permanent trait versus a temporary experience.
Right. And so by doing that, we also have to be careful about what we say with kids as well. And how we teach kids about that. Because, you know, for example, social emotional learning, if you're teaching a lesson at the beginning of the day, that's great. But what's really powerful is if you embed it and infuse it throughout your day. So if, for example, sticking with this example of anxiety, what if we talked about when are those times where you do feel anxious? When I pause and I think about it, and I can model that, right? Like I can model talking about it, going, I feel anxious when I'm about to take a test. I feel anxious when I'm going to do something new that I'm not sure what the outcome will be. I feel anxious when, and you start to talk about those things and model it for kids, then all of a sudden they start to think about, oh, I feel anxious with this. And they start to add in. And I remember one of my colleagues and I, when we were teaching, and it was around the time of test taking, we would stop on Fridays and talk about test taking strategies. We talk about our own experiences with test taking, and then we'd ask them what their experiences were like. So that by the time the test came, right before the test, we would say, okay, let's take some deep breaths. What are some things we can say to ourselves right now to prepare for this? Knowing that all of you have shared in some way that you feel anxious or stressed when you're about to do that. So you've now taught it mm-hmm. and now you're putting it in context and mm-hmm. you're modeling it again. So you're repeating it. And these are not things that are taking hours upon end. Like you teach it for 30 minutes and then you infuse it. You're looking at 1 or 2 minutes during the times that you're doing it. And that's a great way to infuse teaching. How do I regulate? How do I get in a space that I can access my learning? Because when you think about that punitive piece of discipline, if we go back to that, if you have a child who's anxious and they're in a fight or flight response, and they either are going to leave your classroom or leave the space they're in, they're not supposed to. So they're a runner. Well, then the adults are going to try to run after them to find out where they're at and make sure they're safe. And yet, you know, or if they're in the classroom and they're destroying the classroom, then the teacher is probably going to try to take her class, the rest of the class, and have them leave so that they could be safe.
Mm-hmm.
But this might be where it gets a little tricky.
Yeah. Yeah. And, 'cause like all the stuff that you've said are like so many great proactive things, but proactive can definitely prevent a lot of things from escalating to this point, but they don't always. So,
right. Yeah. So now you're in a space of like kid is running. You have a group of kids that you're supposed to take care of. Or the kid is destroying the classroom space, which that does happen. And you have kids. So now you're in a space of like, well, I have to protect the other children. I have to protect myself. Like,
right.
Go into this protection mode. And when we go into that protection mode, what do we typically do? We also, unless we're aware, go into fight or flight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So hard to get back into a calm space.
And so like a strategy, which some people may think, oh, this is ridiculous. Why would you do that? But if we're looking at it from a space of inclusion and we're looking at it from a space of this is a learning opportunity, because all of what we deal with in schools is truly a learning opportunity for anyone involved, even though it might be hard to see it that way. If I have a child who is destroying the classroom, if I've taken the time to teach the entire class about how to be aware in my body, how to be present in my space, I've learned some deep breaths. I've learned about maybe some saying some things about I am safe, I'm okay, I will be okay, mm-hmm. I'm having a hard time right now, or even expressing like if I am struggling in that moment, and I know that if I can get to just enough of that frontal lobe to assess the situation to know that I'm not being harmed, you could leave your students in the classroom space with you, pull them back, and have them thinking about how they're regulating themselves in this moment,
mm-hmm.
how you're regulating yourself in that moment, and how you can send positive thoughts to the child who's being disruptive. Like it's going to be okay. It's hard right now, but we're all in this together. And the reason that's important is because you are now in that moment. I'm not saying this is easy. None of this is easy.
Yeah.
But in that moment, you are sending that message to that child that they are not being abandoned. They are not leaving. You are modeling for other children. They are not being abandoned. They are not being left. and we are not rejecting the child who's struggling. So there's not that rejection. There's not that fear. We are using it as a teaching opportunity. Now, it doesn't mean you're not asking other people to come in for assistance. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that at some point you may not leave. It just means that at the starting point, everybody is there and recognizing that we have a shared humanity. There's shared humanity. I see you, you see me, and you're having a hard time right now. And I'm going to model for you how to not have a hard time while you're having that hard time, because that's the part is where it's different. So remember when I was talking about like my son, and I know all the strategies.
Yeah.
But I'm getting dysregulated watching him not do anything. And yeah. I'm tired and I'm not at my best. And so I had to get to the point of like my amygdala, that part of my brain that has no language, got hijacked. How do I get myself in a space where I have the language and I can then say what needs to be said to help my body calm down? And, yeah. and that's hard. I'm not going to say that's easy at all. But when we think about discipline, and like in Illinois, we have SB 100 that says to take away the suspensions and expulsions. You only have a certain number of days you can do for suspensions. Where we have that in place, people still need to learn the alternative. Because otherwise, if we continue with that punitive mindset and the discipline, that punitive discipline, then it comes down to the reality of, you know, the school to prison pipeline. You're basically sending the message to the child that something is wrong with me. I am this, that state of being comes into play versus you're having a hard time. And yeah. this is just a moment in time. I had a student who, this was several years ago, they were looking at placing him in alternative school. And the principal at the time said, I'm not sure he needs that. You know, he's really close to eighth grade, and eighth grade, he will have Chrissy as his teacher. And the reason she said that is not because I had some amazing gift of some sort, but she knew I was relationship focused. And that if this child had the ability to connect and make that relationship with me, the likelihood was greater that he didn't necessarily need to leave the public school space. It was around that he needed somebody to like be an advocate for him and see him. And so when she shared that with me, one of the things that I always did was as an eighth grade teacher is since eighth grade ended a little bit earlier than the rest of the grade levels, I would go and observe the students that I was going to receive. I would just observe just once or twice. And this student I found was very relational, but he also was very aware of his environment and very observant of other people's strengths and triggers.
Mm-hmm.
All have triggers.
Right.
And I say that because like something that we need to really be observant of is not just the triggers that students have, but the triggers we also have. And so when I was observing this particular individual, teacher's doing stuff and she's talking and whatnot, and he raises his hand and he goes, are you being nice to us because Miss M is sitting there and watching us? And I'm like, this kid.
Yeah. He like, he kind of knew how to.
He's wanting to. I was yeah. like, look at this guy. He's just going to go in. Right.
Yeah.
He took a deep breath and she did, you know, a purposeful ignore of the statement.
Yeah.
But I could see. And then I looked at the whole class. Like here he is, you know, trying to, you know, poke and prod. And
right.
the other kids were just had like a very like disengaged affect. And I'm like, ooh, they're not really feeling good about themselves as a whole, as a collective. Let me see what I can do. So when they started in eighth grade, like that first week, I was meeting with them for lunch, having pizza with them. I was doing, you know, I was talking with them and I just was curious about them. And I just became curious about them. And the more curious I got about them, the more they started to look at school a little bit differently. And I asked that particular year, I asked my principals if I could do a student business with them, because I felt like if they had an opportunity to contribute versus being the ones who were taking,
mm-hmm.
it may change some things differently. It may change their experience differently. And so sure enough, they started a business and, you know, they got to name the business. We partnered with the PTA and it was market days. And so we just sold the holiday things for market days, like the seasonal things. And the kids, you know, created commercials, and we talked about, okay, how are we going to collectively, you know, benefit from this? And so we had an outing planned. If we got X number of dollars by this time, we would have this outing that was a team building outing. And then they also would then contribute back to their school for the school's benefit. So they ended up they hit their mark, and actually a little bit more than that over the year. And they purchased the graduation tablecloths with the school logo. And that was their contribution to the school that got listed in the, you know, in the eighth grade commencement program. So they got acknowledged for that. And then they also had their team building. So the kids who were disengaged, I mean, flat affect, were like, we're not interested in this. That's what I saw at the end of seventh grade. By eighth grade, they're staying after school, helping me box, you know, food to give to whoever purchased things. They're working with me in the middle of the day, doing stuff, making sure the orders are ready. They're putting out commercials. They're creating, like, kids who supposedly, here are kids with disabilities that they're struggling, they can't manage. And this particular student completely fell off the radar for looking at therapeutic placement. What did I do? I created an engagement experience that they had voice in, they had choice in. I also taught them about, like, how they learn, what works for them, what doesn't work for them. They gave me feedback, and I modeled behaviors for them throughout the course of the year. And if I was frustrated, I didn't physically show my frustration. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, I wasn't yelling, I didn't change my face, because facial expressions make a whole world of difference. I instead talked to them about it. You know, sometimes I would have the social worker with me, or I'd have the speech pathologist, and we would talk it through in circle and talk about those experiences. And they would have space then for me. Like, I would give them a feedback survey in the middle of the year, like at the end of the quarter, asking them what I could do differently to help them. So I gave them those opportunities, and you can do that at any age, even for little ones. What's helpful, what's not helpful. It helps to make them self-aware.
Be sure to check the show notes for all of the links to the resources we mentioned in this conversation, and stay tuned for the second part of the conversation, episode 153, where we discuss debriefing, de-escalation, and teaching kids how to repair relationships. And then finally, if you want a comprehensive plan for putting executive functioning support in place on your school team, then check out the School of Clinical Leadership. I'll show you how to support students' executive functioning for direct intervention, but then I'll also give you the tools you need to make sure it's embedded throughout their day. To learn more about the program, go to drkarendudekbrandon.com/clinical leadership. If you have a suggestion for a guest, or if you're interested in being a guest on De Facto Leaders, please send me an email at talktome@drkarenspeech.com. As always, it helps me so much if you share the De Facto Leaders podcast with your friends, or if you leave me a rating or review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time. Do you want to simplify your school's technology, save teachers time, improve students' performance on state assessments without just teaching to the test? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/BE to learn how IXL's research-based teaching and learning platform can help you achieve all these goals. That's IXL.com/BE. There are lots of solutions out there for giving students what they need when they need it. But when do they actually do all of those things? You need flexible time. When added into the master schedule, flex time enables students to get extra help or intervention, meet with teachers, make up work, get physical exercise, and try new enrichment offerings. If you're thinking of giving it a try, check out My Flex Learning, which unlocks the benefits of flex time without the common challenges. Its intuitive design makes implementation and training a breeze. Make your flex time work for you. Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off your first year. That's myflexlearning.com/BE.